BizNews Power Hour.
Welcome to the BizNews Power Hour. I'm Michael Apple. It's Thursday, the 17th of February. Well, it's a great show we've put together for you this evening. It's diverse, it's interesting, and it's got something for everyone, I suspect. We kick off with editor Alec Hogg speaking to a man who guarded President Nelson Mandela for 5 years. He was our country's first citizen. Don't miss this interview with Rory Steyn. It's complete with stories about one of the most loved and missed icons around the world. Rory is also going to be giving a fireside chat at our upcoming BizNews Investment Conference, or BNC3. If you can't be there, you'll get to eavesdrop on that conversation tonight. Then our London correspondent, Linda van Tilburg, is in conversation with entrepreneur Regine LaRue, who's come up with a fantastic initiative to repurpose plastic bags and help with the unemployment problem while she's at it in Hout Bay. You'll hear my voice in conversation with our partners across the border in Namibia as I give a snapshot of what was on our radar from the week. And then, as always, our partner, the Financial Times, has all the international business news you need to know. To Nadia Swart now in the Mother City with your news headlines.
Rightrock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
President Cyril Ramaphosa says reducing red tape will benefit businesses and unlock investment. He's defending his decision to appoint a red tape team led by former Exxaro CEO Sipho Nkosi. During his State of the Nation address, Ramaphosa said this team would be used to make it easier for businesses to do business. Meanwhile, Ramaphosa also told MPs that he refuses to respond to some of the criticism levelled against him during this week's SONA debate. He says the focus should be on constructive criticism from MPs, not on insults about his attire. The National Prosecuting Authority says it will resist further delays in the long-awaited corruption trial of Jacob Zuma and French arms company Thales, and stressed that despite any appeals, the matter must proceed. The NPA expressed this a day after Judge Piet Koen in the KwaZulu-Natal High Court in Pietermaritzburg dismissed all 6 applications Zuma launched to challenge the legitimacy of his corruption prosecution and ordered that the case against him and Thales should proceed on the 11th of April 2022. In a 61-page ruling, Koen reiterated what the NPA previously argued, that Zuma did not have the legal right to appeal the dismissal of his special plea challenge to state advocate Billy Downer's title to prosecute him now. After citing multiple court rulings, Koen said it was clear that such an appeal could happen only if and when Zuma was convicted of the arms deal corruption he is accused of. The High Court in Makanda has dismissed Shell and Mineral Resources and Energy Minister Gwede Mantashe's application for leave to appeal a ruling that temporarily halted a seismic survey off the Wild Coast. The interim interdict remains in place, and Judge Gerald Bloom made the ruling on Thursday in which he dismissed the application with costs. Shell and the minister had applied for leave to appeal Bloom's December ruling, which blocked the seismic survey pending a hearing set down for the 30th of May, that will challenge the oil company's environmental authorization. Given the arguments brought before him, Bloom said that he is of the view that an appeal would have no reasonable prospects for success.
Retail tycoon and one of South Africa's most revered businessmen, Christo Visser, has won back billionaire status in dollar terms. The increase in Visser's wealth has been driven largely by his investment in the food retail business he helped start, ShopRite, which has become the country's standout retail performer. Visser's 10.67% stake in ShopRite, the second largest shareholding behind the Public Investment Corporation, is valued at 14 billion rand, which is around $910 million. When you include his other investment vehicles and family interests, it drives his effective economic stake closer to 12%, making him a billionaire in dollar terms, a feat that has evaded him since Steinhoff collapsed in the latter end of 2017. Prior to the Steinhoff collapse, Visa had amassed a wealth of $5.8 billion, which made him one of the richest men on earth. He lost around $4 billion owing to fraud and misappropriation of funds at the multinational retailer. It's also worth noting that after the Steinhoff saga, Visa reduced his economic interest in ShopRite from around 18% to 12% to free up liquidity. Visa's interest in ShopRite have become the crown jewel of his empire. In 2014, he sold Pepco, which was unlisted at the time, to Steinhoff in a share-based transaction worth around 63 billion rand in exchange for 20% of Steinhoff. The Steinhoff paper became monopoly money as the shares fell by over 90% when they uncovered accounting irregularities and creditors forced the sale of his stake following the collapse. Visa sued Steinhoff for around 60 billion rand, and the embroiled retailer finally settled with shareholders over 4 years later. Steinhoff's 25 billion rand global settlement plan has been approved by Steinhoff claimants and regulators. Visa will receive a fraction in a part share, part cash settlement. Visa's other listed interests include investment holding companies Brait and Invicta. Brait is a private equity firm that was listed before the global financial crisis and went on to become the darling of the JSE in subsequent years. It is another of Visa's business interests to come under significant pressure. In true private equity fashion, management was aggressive and its 2015 acquisition of UK retailer New Look derailed the business, flooded with debt and a non-performing asset, and lost over 100 billion rand in shareholder value. It is difficult to calculate Visa's economic interest in Brait, even given his approximate direct 27% shareholding in the business, worth around 1.5 billion rand. His private investment arm, Titan, has recently underwritten part of a 3 billion rand convertible bond that can be converted to equity in time, and this increases shareholding. Visa's industrial arm, Invicta, faced a similar fate. Its shares fell by more than 95% since its peak, with a culmination of headwinds hitting the business at once. It has since recovered somewhat, and its interests in the business are valued at over 1 billion rand. Just to clarify, Visa could have achieved this landmark $1 billion milestone much earlier in the ShopRite rally, but a lack of information on his private investments makes it tough to accurately value. These values have been calculated from his shareholding in the aforementioned companies. His economic interests in the business may vary slightly, depending on the other financial instruments, such as bonds, that his private investment arm Titan holds. There's little doubt Christo Visa is one of the best South African business people. To build a $5.8 billion empire, you have to take some serious risks. Sometimes, as we've seen in the case of Steinhoff, Brait, and Invicta, things don't go as planned. Such is life and in business. It's tough and ever-changing, leaving the mediocre behind. Regardless of Visa's loss of wealth, his legacy will live on. An unbelievable business person who has created tens of thousands of jobs and livelihoods for ordinary South Africans.
Rory Steyn, I'm looking forward to having a fireside chat with you in the Berg at what we call BNC3. It's our third BizNews conference, and it's a different format. We're going to be talking about you. The topic of the talk is your time as Madiba's bodyguard.
And I'm looking even more forward to it than you are, because it's just got such a wonderful reputation, great location. And I'm very happy to tell
my
story.
Have you been there before?
I have. We stayed there for about 3 nights years ago, played a bit of golf there. It's just a great setting, isn't it? I mean, anywhere in the Berg's a great setting, right?
Drakensberg Sports Resort's golf course has now been upgraded to the 26th best in South Africa. And given how many golf courses we've got here,
yeah,
that's a very high rating.
Absolutely. I mean, even top 100 is going to be a proper track.
Yeah. So what are you going to be telling us?
Well, essentially, you know, people love to hear the stories about the privilege that I had to serve Madiba for the 5 years that he was our president. You know, how that came about, meeting him for the first time, especially given the fact that not only was I a white cop, but I also came from a security branch background. So Nelson Mandela and Rory Steyn should really have been mortal enemies. And yet he accepted me, and not only did he accept me, he rebuffed an attempt, I guess you would call it, because when the intelligence services discovered that this young team leader who is assigned to the president, you know, has the background that I had, they went to him and said, listen, you know, you need to get rid of this guy. And that would have been the simplest thing for him to say, yeah, okay. There would have been 100 other guys in the queue equally as qualified as I was, Alec. And he said, no, He said, you leave that boy there. He's done a good job and he's proved himself. And he later said to me that in any case, we are not looking for people who are carrying out instructions in the old days, in the old system, and everything that the security police were known for. He said, we want the people that were giving those instructions. It was a real light bulb moment for me, Alec, because what it said was that I was employed to do a job, and that job demanded loyalty to my president, to the head of state. But long before I was called on to be loyal to him, he was loyal to me. He didn't have to do that. As I said, he could have just said, yeah, okay, move on.
It's incredible. I was actually thinking about our conversation this morning and remembering, yes. I met him twice. And in both times, he said, it's an honor and a privilege to meet you. I'm sure he did that with everybody.
That's
and
who he
shook
was.
His hand, this
yeah.
tall man
yes.
With just such a presence. And I will remember sure. that until my dying day. Okay, so lots of people saying, yeah, we've made him into something bigger than he was.
Well, I'm biased, but I think that even compared to a Gandhi or a Churchill, to me, he is the human being of the 21st century.
That's extraordinary, because this is a guy that you spent 5 years very, very close to.
Yes.
So you would have seen his flaws. You would have seen the ups and downs, and you still say that?
Absolutely. And you know, Alec, that I because I'm asked that question quite often, and what I can say is that I watched him because of this position I was in. I watched him from an up-close and personal perspective change the country. But he also changed me very profoundly. Because when I came into that job, if you pause the movie at 94 and roll it back to 1990, when I was actually actively serving in the church's section of the security branch at John Forster Square, when FW made that historic announcement, you know, there was probably a TV on in the tea room or something like that, and we weren't really paying attention. I mean, who listens to politicians, right, when you're a cop? And then the next thing he says, he is going to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally and unban all the banned political organizations. I mean, we know the import of that statement. But when he signed it into law, we as the security branch had no more work, because the illegal people and illegal organizations that we were focused on were now legal. So when this, 9 days later now, on the 11th of February, President Mandela is released from Victor Verster. He goes to the Grand Parade in Cape Town to make his first speech as a free man. And the world's media are there hanging off every word, because we didn't even know what he looked like, remember?
That's right.
It was illegal to publish a photograph of him or anything that he said. So what is he going to say? He goes to the Grand Parade. He says a lot of things, but one of the tenets of what he said was quoting from the Freedom Charter, where he said, South Africa is for all her people, both black and white. And this cynical cop sitting in his office in John Forster is going, whatever. Of course you're going to say that. That's the party line. You know, we were instructed and trained in what the ideology of the ANC was, because that's warfare 101, is know your enemy's strategy or his philosophy. And I just poo-pooed all that. So that's 1990.
So you thought that was PR?
I just thought that was PR. Of course you're going to say that. It's the party line. 4 years later, I get to meet him, and not just meet him, I get to work with him and to serve in this particular capacity. And all of a sudden, I saw that none of that stuff that he was saying, like, we need to build one South Africa, we need to unite her people, the country is for all of us. I very quickly, and I mean in a matter of months, realized that he's absolutely sincere about that, because you expect that kind of thing to be a facade, or at least it's propaganda and it's a party line that he's, you know, trotting out. But he didn't. He lived it. And I bought into that philosophy of his hook, line, and sinker. You know, I'm not ashamed to say it now, that I didn't believe a word he said in 1990. But coming to serve him in 94, it took a matter of 2 or 3 months for me to say, okay, at the very least, I'm prepared to give this man a chance.
You can't fake because authenticity.
You can't fake that. You can't put facade and Mandela in the same sentence. People often ask me what he was like. And the greatest compliment I think that I can pay, and the easiest way to describe him, is to say to you that how you perceive him, you've met him twice, if you've never met Mandela, how you perceive him off a 42-inch TV screen That's exactly how he is. Because he had this very rare quality of treating every person that he interacted with the same. Whether he was speaking to another head of state, or the gardener, or his family, or to us as his bodyguard, he treated everybody the same. And that is so rare. Not even mentioning how rare it is amongst politicians, but rare of any leader to be so utterly consistent in treating people exactly the same.
Very rare of any human being.
Any human being, you're right. Yeah.
Too many chameleons around who
too many
for the circumstances.
And they just, you know, they hunt with their hairs and run with their hounds.
But he's clearly influenced your life, given the way that your eyes
very
opened.
Profoundly, yeah.
You still live in South Africa?
Yes, I live in South Africa and I'm going nowhere. And I took a decision sometime during those 5 years that the things that I learned from him, and there were many, and we can, you know, we can talk about those when I get down to the Berg. But I've tried to, so I have three boys, and I've tried to teach that kind of, those values that I learned from him to, you know, to my sons. And I try and put them into practice every day. I probably fail every day, but there's so much that we can learn from him, you know. Just the statement he made, and I paraphrase it, where he said, it's so much better to sit down with your enemy and talk to him than to fight. I mean, that is a life lesson and as a value and as a principle. You know, it can save this world so much heartache, you know, so many human lives, so much death, so much conflict, just by listening to a simple yet profound statement like that.
At BNC 2, so we have two conferences a year, that was at the Spring Conference in September.
Yeah.
Rob Herzog had a very strong speech. One of the tenets that he brought out, he said, if Madiba were alive today, he would vote DA.
DA, yeah.
Do you think he would?
Well, I don't know if he would. He was such a party man that I think probably not. But the principles, what Herzog was saying, the principles that he would have voted for were not visible in his own party by then. So I think Herzog was on the money.
If you look into the future and the way that South Africa is going today, and we know this isn't what Nelson Mandela would have wanted, Is it possible for us to recapture that Madiba magic?
Alec, I'm an optimist, and I will believe that till the day that I go to my grave. The only reason for that is that every single day we still see South Africans of every hue and color doing wonderful acts of kindness for and to one another. And I have to say that at some point that has got to, you know, it's like that cliche about the, you know, it only takes one flame flickering somewhere to push away darkness. And I think that there is more than enough of that kind of goodwill. And I don't say this looking through rose-colored spectacles, you know. I just see it every single day. And I think that once we get a grip on the kind of chaos and mayhem that we've had to endure for the last 10 or 11 years, evidenced by what happened in our, you know, in KZN and Gauteng in July last year, once we get a grip on that, I think that we are going to be the country that everybody wants to invest in. And I'm not an economist. However, we need a change at the top. I'm not saying the president. I have a lot of respect for our president, but those immediately below him, I don't think are leaders that are going to take us there.
Bobby Godsell, in an interview that we had a little while ago, said that South Africa is blessed by its people but cursed by its leaders. Well, I'm paraphrasing him.
Yeah.
And if our leaders could just perhaps go back and imagine they spent the 5 years that you did with Madiba.
But I mean, so did Cyril. You know, President Ramaphosa, at the time that I served Madiba, was the general secretary of the ANC. So he didn't have a ministerial portfolio. He wasn't a VIP in the terms of what I, as a cop in the VIP protection unit, understood a VIP to be. So he went through that road. And let us never forget that it was he and Ruth Meyer that actually got us to where we are now as a democratic society. And I don't know... whether it's this whole thing of, you know, fighting with one hand tied behind his back because he's got such problems from within. But I believe if you look at these, even my fellow South African speeches, you know, from the first one that he made up until this very last one, I have respect for his abilities.
So you would have seen a lot of Cyril as well, yes, during those 5 years. Do you think he's for real? In other words, when he stands up and he says things that he intends doing, is he saying it again in an authentic manner, or is he just towing a PR spin?
I think there's a bit of both. I like to believe that he is an authentic leader and a good president. I think that he has to pacify or play towards certain factions, you know, in order to keep his power base. And I'm not a politician, so I don't know even whether that statement is accurate. I'm merely going on the evidence of my eyes. So what I see is a man who has the wherewithal, is probably the right guy for the moment, but just severely hamstrung by those below him and also all of this party infighting. I want to tell you one really cool story, though, and this is an absolutely true story, Alec. You remember that there was a parliamentary determined deadline by which time the constitution had to have been ratified. And as we know, Cyril and Roof were the two that burned the midnight oil to kind of get this document over the line. And so let's say that it was the deadline expired on a Sunday night, and on Monday morning in Parliament had to ratify the South African constitution, not the interim one, the actual one, because this is about 96 I'm talking about. So now Madiba calls the whole shooting match to Mahlamandlovu, which is the official residence in Pretoria, his official residence, where he didn't stay, but every other president does. And there's this long dining room table, beautiful old wooden table, and he puts the ANC delegation down the one side, the Nats down the other side, and he says, "No, right now we're not leaving here until we've knocked this thing out, because the deadline expires at midnight." So it's a Sunday afternoon. It's very boring for us because we've driven up the highway from Houghton, where he lived, and this negotiation is going on, and you know, we're just waiting for it all to end so we can take him back and go home to our families. So I'm sitting outside this dining room, inside the official residence, when the doors of the dining room fly open, and out comes Cyril. So I get up, and I didn't know him by any other term as chief, because that's what my ANC colleagues called him, because he was the general secretary of the ANC. As I said, he didn't have a formal government position. So I got up, and I said, "Chief, can I help you? You know, is there something you need?" He said, "Yes. Where's the nearest TV?" I said, "Well, it's down the hall. Why do you need it nearest TV?" He says, "I just want to know who's leading the Grand Prix." And that's a true story.
It's me and Gary Jordan again. We're doing our quick sort of update. It's not going to be quick because I know, Gary, you've got a whole lot of stuff in your cellar. Hi, thanks for joining me on Kerry's Corner.
Thanks, Kerry. Busy day. Lots of grapes coming in at the moment. You'll see some activity behind me still. I'm set up in the cellar as I'm running from room to room as we busy taking in grapes for our bubbly, some lovely Chardonnay, and lots of fermentations happening from what's happened over the last week.
So have you started serving your Blanc? Because that's what I was sort of interested in. I thought that last week when we chatted, everybody was talking about Sauvignon Blanc, and you said you thought you might start harvesting your Sauvignon Blanc this week. Have you done that? You disappeared for 5 minutes in the beginning of the interview, so you might have told me that already.
No, so it was the build-up to the harvest was so cool and different, and we ended up taking in our very first two blocks of Chardonnay, but Sauvignon Blanc it is. It's gone back to sort of a normal harvest. Some wonderful flavors. Sauvignon Blanc rolling in at the moment. We stopped today just to take in a little bit of Chardonnay for bubbly because that needs to come in at a slightly lower sugar.
Yes.
But Sauvignon Blanc it is all week for the rest of the week and weekend.
Wow. So how many tons of Sauvignon Blanc are we going to harvest off Jordan this year? Do we know? Do you have an idea?
Yeah, we do bunch counts and we weigh bunches and we can kind of get a very good estimate as to what's going to come in. It's probably around 130 tons of Sauvignon Blanc, in total, spread amongst a few different blocks, more
that's
south
a lot.
And
that's
east
a
facing
lot of
south.
Wine. And Gary, does that go into...
Yeah, it's a bit more than you can drink on a weekend.
It's a bit more than we can do at dinner. Does that go into the chameleon as well? You've got a chameleon Sauvignon, haven't you?
We do, yes. So it'll go into our main Sauvignon Blanc, the Cold Fact, and okay. It'll also go into the chameleon.
And it's looking nice. I know when I spoke to you earlier, you were a little bit worried that it was probably maybe getting a little bit sun-kissed. The grapes, the bunch of grapes that you sent me looked absolutely beautiful. I wanted to eat them. You sent me a photograph of them. But they were looking teensy bit sun-kissed, which I love. Beautiful for aromatics and mouthfeel for Sauvignon Blanc, okay? Nice ripe grapes.
Yeah. Look, one doesn't want too much sun on Sauvignon Blanc because you, in many ways, it's a very delicate grape variety and it doesn't like to grow just everywhere. To do well, it's really got to be high up, cool. You don't want too much sun exposure because, you know, unlike some grape varieties, you'll actually burn off those really delicate sort of tropical Sauvignon Blanc flavors off quite easily.
Well, just for the viewers and the listeners.
When I was sending some photographs earlier, yeah.
I was going to say, for the viewers and the listeners, I'm going to see if I can put into the newsletter maybe next week that beautiful photograph that you sent me this morning looking out from the top of the hill down over the Sauvignon Blanc vineyards. And there was a sort of a mist cloud coming in over the vines. And it just looked absolutely gorgeous. I thought, what a perfect Sauvignon Blanc harvest morning.
Yeah, it was ideal for that time of the morning, 6:30 in the morning. Mm. But a little bit of a wake-up call because we normally get those mists coming in around the sort of end of March, and that kind of heralds a bit of botrytis with it.
Yeah.
As you know, we like a bit of botrytis, particularly if it's clean.
Mm.
And on something like Sauvignon Blanc can make it quite interesting.
Oh, I love
but,
it.
But, yeah, it looks like everything is now dried off a bit.
Okay. And I'm sitting looking at you, Gary. You're in your cellar at Jordan, and I can see people with great big bins of grapes and things that they're obviously putting through to be pressed a little bit there behind you. But I can see an amphora in the background there. Is that where did you get that from? What is that I'm looking at behind you?
It is. Yeah, it's clay amphora. We've got a whole series of them. This is just one of them here. We had to move out of the way today, but it's got some lovely Syrah in it.
Mm.
In the background, what we're looking at, and you can imagine, for those who can't see it, we've got tanks hanging from the ceiling. We've got movable presses on the same level that I'm chatting to you at, and we can literally push the press to the pumice rather than have to pump grapes all over the place. So much more gentle action.
The cellar looks absolutely
fantastic. Today is all
about
white grapes.
Yes. Okay. You know, I'm absolutely loving the flavors that are coming out of those amphora, and I think more and more people, if they can afford to, because they are quite expensive, aren't they? Tell the listeners what an amphora that costs. What does it cost?
An amphora costs about half the cost of a BMW.
Oh, God.
And but it's not like a barrel where... You know, a barrel that you would use perhaps sort of five times and then cut it in half and use it for pot plants.
Yeah,
amphora really has a life, and because it's all clay and it's natural. Yeah,
and,
I know.
And Gary, tell me
not
something.
Not good for the bottom line.
No, those pots. Every time I see any of my friends using one of those sawn-off wine barrels, my heart sort of clinches, you know, and I think, oh. But these amphoras... I would be terrified of them breaking because I've had clay pots and things in my life before and all they need is one tiny little bump and that's them. I mean, how do you protect these things in the cellar?
Yeah, well, this would be an absolute disaster, not only for the really expensive clay amphora that's come out from Tuscany, real precision made and each one signed by the potter that's made it and fired it. But not only that, but you lose the wine and a whole year's worth of work. So You don't want to break them, I promise you.
You don't want to break them. So have you had to sort of rearrange your cellar to house these amphora? Because I would imagine that once they're in place, you don't want to move them anywhere else, do you? It's not like barrels that you can roll around the cellar.
No, but you can, if you've got the right system, and we've got a sort of little trolley system that you can move them around, you can do that, but you don't want to just put them on chocks and then have to roll them on their sides. That's not going to work.
Yeah.
They crack quite easily.
And that's what I think. I mean, as I said, I've had clay pots in my garden before, and one little knock in the right place or the wrong place with the handle of the rake or something, and that pot just cracks in half. So I would be terrified as a wine farmer, having having bought a fleet of BMWs and put them in my cellar, and now they can crack. Anyway, so that's that. Talk to me about the rest of the week. Are we doing Sauvignon Blanc the whole week at Jordan?
Yes. So other than the bubbly for our Blanc de Blanc, which means it's coming out of Chardonnay only, we're doing a Blanc de Blanc Chardonnay today. And that'll go into, to be used for sparkling wine.
Yes.
But we're using a series of different yeasts. Now, it's quite interesting because what we use for bubbly is this French EC1118, and there's various forms of it, but a Bayanis-type yeast, especially made for bubbly. And then for Sauvignon Blanc, in this case here in my hand, I've got some of this yeast coming from South Africa, made at Anki Yeast, specially selected for South African conditions, and really great to bring out those intense tropical fruit flavors on Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay, good. So
this is VIN 13.
Okay, and you don't, for the Sauvignon Blancs, you're not going for natural fermentation. So you add the yeast, and you've selected those yeasts specifically to match the clone of vine that you've got in your vineyard.
That's right, yeah. For the outlier Sauvignon Blanc, which we barrel ferment, that would be natural fermentation.
Mm.
But for a standard sort of Sauvignon Blanc that you and I would be drinking gallons of, that would be fermented. And you want to know that you're going to get exactly the right kind of flavors. You want to control that you're not going to get vinegar and all sorts of other possible problems coming from
And aside from that, tank. We want some consistency because everybody knows that Jordan Sauvignon Blanc tastes like this. And every year it tastes like this, and that's why we buy it, because we like it. And so, as you say, you can control the quality. I mean, it's a good quality control thing. And you've obviously done loads and loads of research and what have you to make sure that you've put exactly the correct yeast with the right grape. Mm. Okay, well, that's perfect.
And that's just one of a numerous yeasts that we'd use.
Yes. Is yeast a massive part of your pricing? Is yeast expensive?
Not really.
Isn't it?
Barrels are expensive, and all the kind of hardware that you see in the background are expensive.
Yes. And otherwise, we catch up next week for another quick update on the Jordan harvest and what is going on in the Jordan vineyards and the Jordan winery. Thank you so, so much as ever. Have you got something in your glass? What have you swirling around in your glass?
I do. I've got some newly fermenting Sauvignon Blanc, so you can actually see how cloudy it is. It's already, it starts off at somewhere around 230 grams of sugar, and it's now down to about 190. So you can't really drink it, but you can start getting those wonderful flavors of Sauvignon Blanc.
I can smell it. Even though I'm just looking at you on a screen, I can smell that Sauvignon Blanc as it is like that. It's such a good, and it looks like cloudy apple juice from Pick and Pay or something, but it is delicious. I love it like that.
Just another crazy week in South Africa as we wait for the next gripping installment of the Zondo Commission report coming out this week. You guys have managed to put together a very, very good explainer on the Danel issue. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, Gary, I tried my best. It's a complicated report, but I try to break it down as best I could. And it's looking at the state arms manufacturer, Danel. I mean, it's in a really bad position. Its electricity got disconnected earlier last week 2.4 million rand in arrears. I mean, it had to pay 300,000 rand. And this is a national key point. I just have to remind you, the city of Tshwane saying, no, we're not gonna stand for that anymore. So they had to pay 300K and then they could be reconnected. But this is after the company wasn't able to pay at least 636 million rand in salaries is still owed to staff, and 900 million rand is owed to suppliers. The state capture inquiry saying they really are not sure whether the main shareholder or the only shareholder, the South African government, is going to be able to breathe life back into this crippled entity. The state capture inquiry report, go look at that explainer if you can. I'm not going to get into it now, but basically from a board level, it was just a string of very bad decisions enforced from the Sachsenwald Shebeen by the Guptas to Lynn Brown, the public enterprises minister and her predecessor, Malusi Gigaba. They are all implicated in very horrible ways, and everybody in South Africa is pulling their hair out saying, when is law enforcement going to act?
Well, we'll watch that one. But a turnaround story is what Danel needs, and another turnaround story is ArcelorMittal. Alec Hogg, founder of BizNews, has been pretty negative about that company for a number of years now. But he sat down with Cobus Verstaat, who's the CEO. They've had an amazing turnaround story. And tell us a little bit more about that, because it sounds pretty genuine.
So this is a company that from 2010, as a group, the ArcelorMittal group, had lost 20 billion rand, 12 billion of that in cash losses. But since he took over in, I think it was about 2018, he's really looked to sort of trim AMSA down a lot. And they've upped their production recently from, I think, 2.2 million tons to 3 million tons. But this is off a peak of 7 million tons of steel in recent years. So they're slowly getting back on their feet. But they have had probably the best year, reported year in the last 15 years, 8 billion rand in operating profit. This off a loss of 963 million rand the year before. So, Alec Hogg having a fascinating 30-minute sit-down with Cobus Verstaat to find out how they've managed to turn things around. And he obviously presides over a company that is the best-performing share on the JSE over the last year at least.
And then just lastly, the global law firm Baker McKenzie is in the spotlight for being both referee and player in its work for Bain. This Bain story won't go away, and it just seems to be sucking more and more big international names into it. Is it a case of that the big guys just do what they want, and now suddenly there's a spotlight and the cockroaches are scuttling?
You know, this is, to her credit, the work of advocate Erin Richards here. As somebody within the legal fraternity, she said, hold on, from a cursory reading of the State Capture Inquiry report and the Nugent Commission report, which looked at the South African Revenue Service, there is a law firm, and there are other law firms as well, but she's focused her energy here on Baker McKenzie, which is a global law firm that Bain and Co. used both as a company to give legal advice and help them prep for their submissions for the Nugent Commission, but then also announced that this is the company, this legal firm is going to conduct a transparent and independent investigation into Bain and Co.'s actions at the South African Revenue Service. Now, how can you be giving somebody legal advice on one hand, but then also investigating them on the other? So, and myself, Advocate Erin Richards, and Bain whistleblower Ethel Williams had a great 30-minute sit-down where we sort of spitballed this notion of, can you hide behind legal privilege? Legal privilege can only be waived by a client. And Ethel Williams, who was supposed to oversee the independent and transparent investigation, he was never, ever given the report by Baker McKenzie. There are 10 partners in the local branch of Baker McKenzie. BizNews is going to be seeing if we can get some sort of a response out of them, because the hands, it appears, are very dirty.
Thank you, Michael. Another fascinating story I quickly caught up on this morning was the massive value destruction being wreaked at the moment by Naspers and the process directors. Go check that out. That's on biznews.com.
I'm Lona van Tolberg for Biz News. There's an initiative in Hout Bay in the Western Cape to crochet plastic bags into shopping and beach bags, and it's putting bread on the table of households in the area. Local resident Regine Leroux is behind the Rebag Reuse initiative, and we have her here in the Biz News virtual studio. Regine, where did this idea come from?
Afternoon, Linda, and thank you for the opportunity. It was actually born from the pandemic and during lockdown, when all of us had to go back and find our old hobbies, and mine being knitting and crocheting. But there's only so many blankets that you can actually crochet from wool, and I get bored quite easily. So I was looking for new challenges and new ways to crochet. And one morning when I went running, when the lockdown was slightly less severe, I saw a plastic bag, and something in my memory somewhere reminded me of seeing ladies, housekeepers and nannies years ago during their tea breaks and lunch breaks, crocheting the most beautiful mats and things out of plastic shopping bags. So I thought, let me see if I can't also get that right. And the first few that I tested and played with were disastrous, I won't lie. But again, being up for a challenge, I found a way of cutting the bags into strips. And lo and behold, it worked. It was very, very exciting to see how the plastic got transformed into another plastic bag. I've actually started off with shopping bags, and that's still one of the key ranges that we have at the moment.
So how did you get the local ladies involved in crocheting?
During lockdown, as I said, with this crocheting, I also thought, I think there's, you know, opportunities with other people creating a small income for themselves. But as I was thinking about this, not really paying too much attention to the, I mean, there's lots of things that you think about during a lockdown. Somebody that I had met some time ago in the harbor, she saw me crocheting one day, and she said, wouldn't I mind teaching some of the ladies, there's a group of ladies at the Half Bay Harbour, how to crochet. And I said, with the greatest of pleasure, and I met up with them and then showed them also how to actually repurpose old t-shirts and things, but also how to repurpose empty bread bags, how to cut it and how to crochet it. And it was just wonderful to see the excitement that these ladies had with being able to transform plastic into different products as well. And that's where it slowly but surely started. And one of the key things when it comes to crocheting, it can be so frustrating while you're busy crocheting something and your material's finished. So what you have now got three ladies that actually help to cut the plastic. So any soft, clean plastic, they cut into the beautiful strips for us. And then we can repurpose that into different products.
So what is the stories of the ladies involved, and how did this change their income?
These ladies just inspire me on a daily basis, and I just had so many lessons I learned from them. They're just incredible. The first one is Seta Adams. She lives in the harbour, and she hadn't been employed for 3 years. And her cousin actually was one of the ladies that got me involved initially. And when I asked Maureen, who was a lady, who can perhaps cut this for us, she told me about Seta. Now, Seta didn't really know that she was being signed up for this. So she got these plastic bags to cut. And she said to me the other day, you know what, I had such a dim view when Maureen asked me to cut this for me, to cut the plastic. But you know what, I thought, oh, let me just do it. And then when she got paid that first time after cutting the plastic, and realizing for the first time in 3 years, tonight you can actually go and buy bread for the family and not be dependent on a SASSA grant. It was just this moment of realizing there's more to it. And then also just seeing this her self-confidence to grow as she got more plastic to cut, getting out of her shell. And she's now being full-time employed as well. So she's not cutting for us at the moment, but it's just wonderful to see the growth of Seta and how she's grown. But the other day, and the other story I'd love to share with you is of Jane Hoffman. Mm-hmm. She's also a lady from the harbour, and she's a grandmother of two. And she very proudly shared with me the other day that her granddaughter has just finished matric, grade 12. And she is so happy that she's now going to go, Jane's going to go and buy some data for her granddaughter so that she can go and apply to nursing colleges. And often we think it's just an empty piece of plastic bread bag that you throw away. It's a piece of rubbish. But repurposing it into another product, another bag, it's helping these ladies to be able to buy essentials, to be able to put bread on the table. And it's not just a piece of waste. So ultimately, we're also keeping it from the landfill, from our oceans. There's just so many different aspects of this project that it's touching.
Yeah, because it's plastic, it's strong, and it will last.
It's so durable. Somebody told me the other day, they didn't actually realize how durable it is. And I must admit, mine that I made for myself, I intended to use it as a shopping bag. I actually use it for everything. And it's still going strong. Another lady the other day, she commutes between provinces from work. And she said to me that it's still going strong. And I actually saw it and I couldn't believe it. She uses it every single day. And it's still perfectly, perfectly going very strongly. So very happy to have seen that.
How is the Hout Bay community supporting you?
The community are incredible. The households are collecting all of their soft plastic for us. And we have a centralized point at the Fiddlesticks Haberdashery, who's very, very kindly collecting the bags for us. We've got a number of restaurants who have toasted sandwiches, and they keep all of this, the empty bread bags for us. Also six-pack wrappers, some of the restaurants keep that for us. And it's just been incredible. The hairdresser keeps their aprons for us. And even in Woodstock, the neighborhood old age home, they have a feeding scheme and they keep all of their bread bags for us. So they're also actually a beneficiary of sales of our bags. So whenever we sell a bag, a percentage goes to a lady that crochets it, who cuts it, and to a local charity. And Noah is one of the recipients of the funds that come through from the sales.
And do South Africans want to buy these bags?
They are incredibly supportive. I think what's important just to keep in mind, it does take about 8 hours. It's a full day's work to make one bag, and that doesn't include cutting it. And there's about 30 empty bread bags that goes into one bag. So there's actually quite a lot of work that goes into it. But we have also seen that the international guests, tourists, love these bags. It's great gifts. I'm very thrilled that some of these bags have made their way to Las Vegas and Hamburg and Germany, to Switzerland. So it's slowly but surely really taking off. And we're only 8 months into this project. So I'm very, very grateful for all the support that we're seeing with this initiative.
How many ladies are involved in this project at the moment?
There's currently 11. Three ladies are cutting for us, and then there are eight ladies who crochet, but they're all actually doing their own spare time as well for an additional income. So they're not fully employed. They're not full-time employed at all. It is just extra pocket money for them to be able to supplement their current incomes.
Where do you want to grow this to? Are you planning to add more ladies or more products?
Definitely. I think there's so many opportunities. There's so much talent that we have, and specifically in Africa. So then the immediate next step, we are looking at Pretoria. I actually have a crochet and a cutter in Pretoria. And then definitely to see how can we expand this into the rest of Africa. We have the most amazing continent. We have the most amazing talent. And it's definitely one of those big, hairy, audacious goals of expanding it. But first, want to make sure that I get it right, that we get the pilot right here in Hout Bay.
What's nice about the project is not only that it's creating jobs, but it's also taking plastic that would have landed in landfills or in the sea out of the system.
Definitely. It's insane if you just think of how much plastic there is generated. It's just absolutely crazy. And, you know, you really do start asking, do you really need so much plastic? It's crazy. So I'm really glad that we could find some small way of just repurposing it.
You are also on Backer Buddy. How is Backer Buddy supporting this initiative?
So it's part of raising funds for this initiative. It really is key from a transparency point of view, but also to find ways to supplement the funds for this project so that we can get more crocheters involved, get more cutters involved. The next thing is actually to get people involved to help with sorting the plastic, to see it as a, not something that's, that needs to be thrown away, but that can actually be created into something beautiful. So to create more funds for that, the Back and Buddy project, is I've set myself another big Hairy Audacious goal, which is a slightly shorter term for this year, is to run 100 10Ks. So I'm currently on number 13. So if anybody is willing to sponsor a 10K at a time, it is the, there's a Back and Buddy link that I'll happily share to have a look at that.
Well, thank you, Ruchinda Roo from Hout Bay, for sharing this project with us. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Linda. Appreciate it.
Today is Thursday, February 17th, and this is your FT News Briefing. A ruling by Europe's top court paved the way for Brussels to withhold funds from member states who violate the EU rule of law. Plus, one of the biggest private equity groups bought a company with a popular home finance model called Rent to Buy. We'll look at how it works and whether it works for aspiring homeowners.
One thing that people said was, you know, this was really cool. I got to pick out any house as if I was going to buy it. But some people really struggle to navigate this path to home ownership.
But first, we'll tell you about the markets. I'm Mark Filipino, and here's the news you need. U.S. stocks limped through the day yesterday, but then edged into the black after the Federal Reserve released the minutes from its January meeting. The minutes confirm that the U.S. Central Bank is set to raise interest rates next month and that it's open to more tightening if inflation doesn't calm down. Here's our U.S. economics editor, Colby Smith.
Neither of these 2 points, you know, really present anything demonstrably new in terms of what we already learned from the January meeting, but it is confirmation that they are seeking to kind of maintain as much flexibility as possible here.
Colby, what was the reaction in the Treasury market? Treasuries have been, you know, super volatile lately, and it looks like short-term Treasuries actually rallied a little bit after the minutes came out.
Investors in that space have been, you know, highly sensitive to any signaling from the Fed about the policy path forward. And I think it more broadly speaks to the fact that no one has too clear of an idea of exactly what the Fed is going to do. There's still open debate about whether they're going to move more aggressively at the March meeting and raise interest rates by, let's say, 50 basis points. That's double what they typically do, which is a quarter of a percentage point move. There's uncertainty about what happens after that. So at this point, there's a lot of scope for markets to move quite dramatically on any incremental details that we do get from the Fed.
Colby Smith is the FT's U.S. economics editor. Europe's top court cleared the way yesterday for the bloc to withhold funding from member states that violate the rule of law. The European Court of Justice essentially rejected a legal challenge by Poland and Hungary, and as the FT's Sam Fleming says, it upheld a law that aims to give some teeth to the enforcement of rule of law values.
Which EU member states have signed up to, but which have been under threat in numerous jurisdictions, not just Poland and Hungary, in recent years.
Sam Fleming is the FT's Brussels bureau chief.
So it would be a major step for this actually finally to happen. I think, having said that, I think it will happen. I think the budgetary consequences of that for an individual member state are not clear yet, because the Commission is going to need to make quite focused cases against a member state saying, here are the particular rule of law concerns, here are the ways in which those concerns have a direct bearing on the way EU money is being spent, and therefore that money can be withheld or paused. So it's not a question of just cutting off the entire flow of money on a single day. It's more complicated than that.
Sam also says the European Commission is under pressure to move forward in withholding funds.
We could see action from the Commission certainly early next month. I mean, we don't know, but there is certainly the potential for it to move, in particular against Hungary, where I think a lot of MEPs would expect the first case to be brought.
Sam Fleming is the FT's Brussels bureau chief. The private equity giant Blackstone has been building up its residential property portfolio in the U.S. Last year, it spent $6 billion to buy Home Partners. This is a company that offers a popular home finance model called Rent to Buy. The FT's Mark Vandeveld looked into the company and joined me to talk more about how it works. Hey, Mark.
Hi.
So, Mark, let's start off by breaking down Rent to Buy. How does it work for home seekers?
Well, the idea is that this is something that might be useful for people who want to buy a house but can't right now because they can't get a mortgage, they don't have a down payment ready, they have maybe tarnished credit. What Home Partners says it will do is you can pick a house, not one that's currently available for rent, but one that's on the market to be sold right now. You can't buy it, but Home Partners will. And then they'll rent it to you for up to 5 years with the rents agreed in advance. And if at any time you want to buy them out of the house during that 5 years, you can.
So, Mark, you spoke to some customers, people who were using the Home Partner system. Were they happy with it?
We heard a mix of things from Home Partners tenants. One thing that people said was, you know, this was really cool. I got to pick out any house as if I was going to buy it. And it can be difficult to find rental housing. There isn't much of it. They saw in Home Partners was, or one of the advantages was, they were able to choose from a much wider range of houses. But there's also a significant minority of tenants for whom it doesn't work out that way. So we found 967 houses in Orlando and its surrounding counties that Home Partners has bought since 2015. And of those, 155 have since been sold to individual homeowners.
Is that a typical rate across the company?
It's complicated. Something like 1/5 of the people who rent from Home Partners will end up buying. But that leaves the other 80% who don't. Some of them, according to Home Partners, didn't intend to buy a house in the first place. Some people did intend to buy, but then just find another house that they prefer. There are also cases in which people run into trouble, fail to keep up on the rent, end up in disputes with Home Partners, and things can go wrong that way too.
If 4 out of 5 Home Partners customers remain renters, that means Home Partners and Blackstone are really more corporate landlords than home financiers. Does anyone see that as a problem?
Home Partners occupies an interesting position in this debate. And so a question that arises is, how effective is Home Partners at providing this alternative path to home ownership? And I think you could fairly say if 20% of their tenants end up buying houses that they wouldn't otherwise have been able to buy, then for that 20% of tenants, clearly it is a path to home ownership. But at the same time, if 80% of tenants either don't or can't exercise that option and don't end up homeowners, and if Home Partners then just rents the houses that they bought for those people to other people, then it's creating a permanent stock of rental houses itself. And so I think the question is, just how much of a solution can Home Partners offer to what many people perceive as the undesirable growth of renting in the suburbs?
Mark Vandeveld is the FT's U.S. private capital correspondent. Before we go, Apple CEO Tim Cook's latest pay package comes to $99 million. Okay, it was a banner year. Cook does run the most valuable company in the world, but the FT has learned that a leading shareholder advisory group wants Apple investors to vote no on Cook's pay. Institutional Shareholder Services cites significant concern with the stock award that Cook received last year. A no vote would not block Cook's compensation deal, but it could force him to defend his pay package. You can read more on all of these stories at FT.com. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
The third BizNews conference at the magnificent Champagne Sports Resort in the Drakensberg will be held from the 1st to the 4th of March. It's lining up to be the best so far. We've got a strong lineup of speakers. A single delegate cost is $7,750. For couples, it's $12,950. Book your seat by going onto the BizNews Investment Conference button on the right-hand side of the BizNews.com homepage. See you there.
Well, that's it from this format of the BizNews Power Hour for the week. Starting on Friday is the new BPH Digest show, bringing you an audio platter of the most downloaded interviews from the week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at BizNews.